Can y'all see me okay down here? No. Hi, everybody. I'm a member of this Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon, and my name is Ann Bruning.
Hi.
I'm really happy to be here. It's a gorgeous weekend that we've had already. And I want to thank Barbara and the committee for inviting me. Bud and I had a terrific time when we checked in, and they told us that our room was on the 17th floor. I rapidly grabbed a Kleenex because I knew I was going to get nosebleeds as I went all the way up in that high elevator. And I glanced upward. I kept waiting for the oxygen to come out because I remember Bud saying that if you went above 10,000 feet or something like that, you know, you had to go on oxygen. So anyway, it's a beautiful room, and we have a fantastic view. I also want to thank all the AAs and Al-Anons for being here this morning to hear me talk. You know, it's real important to have some familiar faces as you look out into the audience. And you know that you're loved by everybody in this fellowship, but then there's always some of those few special people that you see quite often and give you that hugs and those words of encouragement. And I'm so happy to see Harriet here this morning. She wasn't sure if she'd be able to make it up, but she did. And I was so happy to see her in the hospitality room this morning. You know, it's because of all of your love and your patience that I keep coming back to Al-Anon, and that I have achieved that level of serenity that Barbara was talking about this morning. And that is how I feel most of the time today. And that's something that I never, ever dreamed would be possible for me. Al-Anon has given me a lot of hope, and it's given me a much, much healthier path in which to walk today. And I'm grateful to AA. You know, I always say that when I give my talk, because I am grateful to AA, that they have given us, that you have given us, this wonderful program. One of the first things that I learned when I went into Al-Anon was that alcoholism was a disease, and I never knew that before. I knew that there was something unusual or different about my husband. I couldn't put my finger on it because I knew that he was a very special person. I knew that he was sensitive and he was warm and he was loving. But then, you know, something would change in him at times. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that there was some reason. And when I came into Al-Anon and I learned that alcoholism was a disease, it was a tremendous burden that was lifted off of my shoulders. I learned in these rooms that alcoholism bankrupts the alcoholic mentally, physically, and spiritually. And I'm here to tell you today that I'm living proof that it also bankrupts the family member, both in mind, body, and spirit. And I found out that Bud did not drink the way that he did because that he wanted to, but because that he thought that he had to drink that way to live, to survive. When I first came into these rooms, I learned the famous three C's. And for those of you that may not have heard them, I would like to tell you today. And that's that I did not cause this disease, that I did not or could not control this disease, and that I certainly could not cure it. And before I go any further, I want you to meet the love of my life. This is my husband, Bud. Bud, please stand. Isn't he cute? Bud just last Sunday celebrated 7 years of sobriety, continuous sobriety, and I am very grateful for that. Take my word for it, he's a walking miracle. You know, in our forum magazine, it's a lot like the AA's grapevine. I read in there one time that it says that we should glance at remembering the past, but not to stare. So this morning, I just want to take you down a stroll, a little bit down memory lane, and tell you a little bit about myself, and then I want to rapidly get on to recovery, because that's what we're all here for this weekend. I am one of four children. I was the youngest. My father was one of those happy-go-lucky sort of guys. And he did spend a lot of time with his family. He used to, as a hobby, he raced cars. We used to go on a lot of picnics and to the movies, and we did a lot of those wonderful things. We were a close family to a point. But he also did one thing when I was very young, and that was he drank excessively. And I'm not here to say this morning that he was or was not an alcoholic. I'm just telling you that he did drink excessively. He used to gather all of us children when we were little out in the front lawn, and he would tell us these outrageous stories, and I just love that. And the kids in the neighborhood, we all just love that. And he was a lot of fun. My mother, whom I love dearly also, was a wonderful, loving person. But also, for some reason, she was very nervous. She was excessively jealous, and she was a worrier from the word go. She was raised, and she felt, and she brought up us girls, that it was the woman's responsibility to take care of her husband and her children, that the man always came first in our lives, that you served the types of foods that the man liked, that if you went out to the movies, you went out to the movies that he wanted to go to the restaurant that he wanted to go to. And in fact, she used to always vote the way that he wanted her to vote. And she just, you know, was just trailed along right behind him. So I grew up learning not to put the focus on me, to always direct my focus onto someone else, and usually the men in my lives. And I was never told that how I felt or what I wanted to do was important. I was always told to take the second or the back seat. So I learned very early on how to stuff my feelings. And I did this in order to keep peace in the family, because this is what I saw my mother would do. Because whenever that she would challenge my father about anything, he would always say to her, you know, do you want a divorce? And his famous way of wording it was, you know, I can give you your walking papers anytime that you would want them. And, you know, when Bud and I got married, I brought these same expressions into our relationship, because that's what I always heard. And I used to say over and over those idle threats, you know, do you want a divorce? You know, I may want a divorce. I used to sit down at the calculator at my desk many, many days, and I would add up how much it would cost me if I moved out on my own. And I never thought I could afford that, because we had four children later on. Whenever I would talk to my mother about the problems that we would have, you know, she didn't really want to talk about it, and she would tell me, now, you know, be sure, you know, to keep this within the family. We don't go outside, and, you know, as the old expression that we hear, we don't air our dirty laundry in public. And so I always kept that, everything just stuffed deep inside. After I graduated from high school, I moved into an apartment with a dear friend that I worked with. Her name was Gail, and we used to frequent the beach a lot. And we went to this one place called in Tampa, Florida, called Beer Can Beach. And wouldn't you know, that's where I met Bud. Surprise, huh? He was in the Air Force, and he and some of the guys would come, and they would bring their beer, and they would have it in the trash cans and some ice, and they would bury it in the sand to keep it cold. Now, I didn't like him at all when I first met him. That first day, I just thought that he was real obnoxious. He used to pitch ice down the front of my bathing suit. You know, he had had a little bit too much to drink, so I didn't care for him at all. My friend and I, we went home, and it turned out that one of the guys had called and invited her for a date, and he brought Bud along for me. Well, you know, you have to make sacrifices sometimes, you know? So anyway, I guess I reluctantly agreed to do this. But after spending that evening with Bud, you know, I got to where I liked him. You know, he was one wild, crazy guy. You know, he liked to have fun and party, and this was real different for me. You know, one thing I didn't mention to you was that my father, later in life, had become a Baptist minister. So, you know, it all of a sudden, it went from wham, one extreme to another in my life. And so everything was real straight laced. So when I met Bud, you know, it was just wonderful then after we started going out. I used to picture that our life would be like those true romance magazines. Did any of y'all used to read those? I loved them, you know. And I would picture, like on the TV shows and everything, that I was going to someday get married and we were going to have this gorgeous little white cottage covered with the ivy and the white picket fence and, you know, have all these children that would just play gleefully in the yard, you know, just everything just rosy. Well, I'm here to tell you that alcoholism really distorted that picture real, real fast. The first night that Bud and I spent apart, now this might surprise you too, but it was because he got drunk. We were at a party, and I know that I left him there. It was under the nicest of circumstances. I know that we didn't have any words or anything like that. You know, I know that I just decided to leave him there. And I went home, and he couldn't find his way home when he got ready to leave. At least that's his story, that he slept in a car all night at a friend's house. So the next morning when he came home, needless to say, we had this big argument. And the typical argument, you know, like, where have you been? Nowhere. What have you been doing? Nothing. Have you been drinking? No. You know, just, and I could, you know, you just, because the, you know, if he didn't argue back with me, that made me even madder. You know, he just wasn't giving me the answers or talking to me in the way that I felt that he should talk to me. So I would have all of this rage inside of me, and then I would always cry. I was such a crier. I cried all the time. And I would tell him, you know, you just don't love me anymore. And another time we had an argument. I don't even remember what it was about, but I was determined to leave him, and I ran and I got in a car, started to pull out of our little drive, and Bud come running outside and jumped on top of the car. He was stark naked. You know, and we lived in this trailer park, just a little old trailer park, and the trailers were real close together. And, you know, right away I was into that projection and thinking about what everybody else is going to think, that, oh, they're going to call the police. And, you know, years can flash before your eyes in a matter of a couple of seconds. And so I thought, well, I better go inside. So I did. I followed him around. And I'm here to say that not even Cadillac had a hood ornament put out as good looking as mine. He's been called hood ornament quite a bit since I've been telling my story. We had began our family right away. That was one thing that I was really excited and eager to do, was to have children, because I love children. But, you know, that night when I wanted to leave him, he was in very, very drunk, not in control of his behavior or mental faculties, whatever. But I didn't either. You know, I couldn't think. And I just wanted to get away from him. And I didn't care about my children then or another time when I tried to leave him. And I just left the children there. All I could think about was getting away from him, and that drinking was our only problem. I can remember years that there never seemed to be enough money for bills. I can remember the children needing shoes, and there just wasn't ever enough money. And I remember one night in particular that my son was showing me how ragged it and the holes in his tennies and everything. And I said, you know, we just don't have the money, honey, to buy these. You know, you're going to have to wait. We're just going to have to make do. You know, checks bounce. Not enough groceries. But then there was always money for booze. And I remember Bud would walk through those doors sometimes, you know, just after finishing one of those conversations with the children, and maybe he'd have a case of beer. And that was always hard to explain to the children, how there could be money for booze and there was not money for other necessities. You know, at times when the lights are turned out and the telephone's turned off. I can remember the chill that would just go up my spine at times when he would pop those Coors Light tops on the cans. And it took a long time for that feeling to go away. You know, he switched to Pepsi Free, and he still pops those tops. And, you know, today I don't have that feeling, but, you know, it took a long time. You know, just those old tapes would play when I would hear that pop sounding. I never, never understood why he drank so much. You know, because he was such a bright, and he was a kind and a very loving man, as I mentioned to you before. But he had that, Jekyll and Hyde personality that we read about. One day he would be considerate and loving, and then another day he would be very verbally abusive and he would be very distant. I played that typical role of the martyr, and I wallowed in self-pity for many years. You know, there's a biblical story that makes me, you know, think of us. There was this drunk that was leaning up against the well, and this crowd was yelling and yelling at him and just very verbally abusive to this man. This other man with the long hair and the beard, he stood there and he very quietly calmed the crowd down and he said, "Ye who are without sin, cast the first stone." Well, they were very, very silent. And then all of a sudden, this rock come flying through the air. And the crowd turned around and looked, and it was the alcoholic's wife. Now, that's me. I always thought I was the perfect one, always the perfect one. I was the one that was without sin. I remember a time that I used to work in the public eye, and Bud used to bring the children, and he would pick me up when I worked nights. And they said, one of them said, "Watch Mommy, as she comes through that door, her smile's just going to disappear." Said, "She smiles when she's working, but then when she comes home, she doesn't smile anymore." And, you know, they watched, and it was real sad when they told me this story. But when I walked through that door, my smile did just fade away. And that's how it was. I could wear this mask and disguise my feelings as long as I was out in the public. That's all that I knew how to do. I didn't want anybody to know what was really inside of Ann. I used to be full of fear inside and full of rage. And I had a lot of resentments. And when I went home, it was like I couldn't hide. I couldn't run from that anymore. I did try to develop a good image in the public eye, and I got involved in a lot of volunteer activities, like the Girl Scouts, a lot of the typical things that we do, the Girl Scouts and the Brownies and Red Cross and a lot of other things. I tried to stay real, real busy, and when I did that, I learned that I did not have to focus on myself. I didn't have to take a long, hard look at Ann. And I didn't have to think about what was going on at home so much. At one point, I had depression really take hold of me real strong. And it felt as if my whole inside was just empty and it was dark. I had a friend describe it to me one time as being the darkness of the soul. And that's the only way that I know how to explain it today. I used to cry, went through periods of crying a lot for no reason. I can remember shutting myself up in my office and saying, "I cannot see anybody today." And I would sit there and I would just cry and cry and cry. I thought often about suicide. I mentioned earlier that I used to get the old calculator out and add up, and I thought, you know, I can't afford to go out on my own anymore. We had four children, and I just couldn't afford to take them and to make do. One of the things that I had learned from my mother, quite by accident, and she had hid it from us children all these years, was that she and Dad were divorced at one time. And she was so ashamed of that. And when she tried to make it on her own with four children herself, she couldn't do it. She just couldn't do it. And those years, you know, divorce was something
at a divorced woman was really looked down upon, and she was considered a failure. So she went back with him, and they remarried. And she always used that original wedding date as their anniversary celebration and the number of years that they had been married. So, you know, I just couldn't do that. So I thought my only way out at that time was maybe suicide. So I used to think about that a lot. And I thought, well, he'd have the insurance and he could hire a housekeeper. You know, we just go on and on and on thinking of how things would work out without us. Then there was times, excuse me, that anger just kind of took hold of me. And then I was just mad at the whole world. And words would just come out of my mouth and just strike at my children like a bolt of lightning. And it would strike down their self-esteem and their spirit. There were days that it didn't seem like anything that they did was right. Everything was wrong. I would be real angry at Bud and fearful sometimes at what might happen, and I would take it out on the children. I was trying to be powerful, and I was trying to control him and his drinking. You know, that old step one, powerless over alcohol, and our lives had become unmanageable. Well, that was the only way that I can know how to describe this, because that's the way it was. I look back now, and I can see that my children at that time were not being bad. I never thought of our slogan, how important is it? That, you know, when children do children things, that some things that just need to be overlooked and not seem to be so important. I never thought about what we hear in this program today, that we should strive for progress and not perfection. Not only in ourselves, but in our family members as well. There were nights that Bud didn't get home until the wee hours of the morning. And, you know, he didn't call. Did any of you alcoholics always call? You know, I learned one thing real quick, that Bud did not have anything in common with E.T. You know, at least E.T. used to phone home. I used to go real quick into that hat of projection, and I would think, oh, you know, Bud's going to have an accident. And then I would feel a lot of relief when I would see that car coming down the road. But then the moment that he walked through that door and he smelled of alcohol and stale cigarette smoke, and his shirt tail would be out and his speech would be slurred and he would be staggering, then that relief would turn to rage. And sometimes, you know, he'd yell back at me, and then other times he would just kind of crawl back into the bedroom and he would just pass out. And I would have all of this inside of me, I'm just wanting to explode, so the only thing that I knew how or what to do was to take it out on my children. And I did that quite often. So this fear that I had inside of me always turned to anger. And we played the same scenario over and over again, how we do that, always expecting different results, and it doesn't happen. I became obsessed with Bud's behavior and what was going to happen when we got home. You know, and I'd play this over and over again at home and at work. And I became physically and emotionally ill, and I was under the doctor's care for this. And I can remember that he asked me, you know, is there anything at all wrong at home? And I could never tell him. I never said anything was wrong. I always painted this beautiful picture of our family. I always said, as I mentioned earlier, that if he would only stop drinking, you know, if he only loved me, then he would stop drinking. I never felt that he loved me. I felt if I was a better wife, kept an immaculate house, then maybe he would stop drinking. You know, in the early days of our marriage, Bud used to help a lot around the house. We had friends that were going to come over, you know. His thing to do was always scrub the bathroom. I don't know why, but he would scrub the bathroom, and that was just great. But, you know, after alcoholism really took hold and he started drinking a lot, he stopped helping me clean house. And the only way that he felt that he was helping is if he raised his feet up and I vacuumed underneath him, you know. Bud did cook once in a while, though. You know, his idea of a 7-course meal was a hamburger and a 6-pack of Coors Light. I always wanted to be first in Bud's life. And I just, all I wanted was for us to be happy. I wanted us to have that special relationship that I used to read about. But this didn't happen, so I started to pray to God that he would take Bud's life. Because at this point, I thought, I can't leave these 4 children with this drunk. You know, so the only way out now is if he should die. But I used to think, I don't want anything embarrassing to happen. You know, here, you know, I'd had this father that was a prominent Baptist minister in town, and my mother was real active in the church, and you know, Fort Walton Beach is not that big of a place, and so I didn't want anything disgraceful to happen. So I used to pray that he would have a heart attack. That just seemed more dignified to me. But Bud did have an accident, and fortunately no one was hurt. But you know, we did, over the years, he had accidents and he had his DUIs, and I guess fortunately the only thing that did suffer was our pocketbook, and any of y'all that have been down that road know that that gets real expensive quick. But you know, when he had that accident that night, the very thing that I had not prayed for, you know, God knew what he was doing. He knew. I always wanted to take control and run things and thought I knew best, but our higher power knows what's best. And the very next day, Bud sought help, and he's been sober ever since. He says that that night that he reached his bottom, that when he had that accident and there was a little girl in the other car, and she was terrified and she was crying, and even, he had been in a blackout, and he sat down on this little pole and that he cried out for help. He said, God, help me. And he knew that night that he had reached his bottom. So for us, you know, that was on Friday the 13th, 1985, and that he went into treatment. So, you know, Friday the 13th to us today is a lucky day. So whenever I go to work and someone says, oh, God, it's Friday the 13th, and I go, yeah, isn't it wonderful? It's a great day to me. So after many, many years of this battling this disease of alcoholism, you know, Bud and I were each led to our programs. He AA and I went into Al-Anon. And the way that I found Al-Anon was through Bud's roommate at treatment. She went and she told me about Al-Anon. And I thought for many years that this was the first time I'd heard about Al-Anon. But it wasn't. But, you know, I wasn't ready to hear about Al-Anon until then. I wasn't ready. So she took me to my first meeting, and I really know that when I walked through those doors that the reason I went was to help keep Bud sober. It was that old thing to support the husband, right, take care of him. And as I mentioned earlier, I found out that alcoholism is a disease, and it's a family disease. And when Bud drank, I reacted to it. That was my part of the disease. Until that time, I don't think that I was allowing myself to feel. I had built up this wall between Bud and I. And, you know, we had been through so much over the years, and I felt like if I continued to feel hurt and disappointment, then it just tore me up. You know, I just continually had this pain inside, and I didn't like this pain. So the only way that I knew how to survive was to build this wall up between us. And when I went to that first meeting of Al-Anon, that was when the bricks, I guess, started to crumble from that wall very slowly. They went around the room and they shared. And they do what I choose to do in meetings today with newcomers. They shared first and they saved time for me at the end. I think if they had started with me, then I would have dominated the whole meeting and I would have cried and there would have been no recovery in that room. So they shared first. And by them doing that, I could listen a little bit and pick up on what they were saying. And the topic that night was on resentment. Now, I didn't think I had any resentments at all. You know, I thought that all of that garbage was behind Bud and I. But boy, when they started talking about it and they started talking about feelings, things began to surface a little bit. They started to come out. And when it came my turn to share, I started crying and crying. And those bricks began to start crumbling from inside. And those feelings, those unfamiliar, scary feelings, you know, when they start coming back, it's real scary. They just began to start surfacing. You know, for years before that meeting, I thought that I was alone, that nobody, you know, I don't know why it is, we always feel alone. We don't think that there's anybody else out there at all that's experiencing the things that we're experiencing. You know, we were in the military, and, you know, there was always a lot of drinking going on, and I used to see people that got drunk quite often. You know, that didn't bother me. It was only when Bud drank and when he got drunk that it bothered me. So I thought that things that happened when we went home, that we were unique, that everybody else went home, they sobered up, and they lived happily thereafter. But when I heard the sharings in that room that night, I found out that I was not alone, and that was a really good feeling. I found that other people had also walked that rocky road of alcoholism. Those people in that room that night, they held out a loving hand of recovery to me. And they gave me a key to unlock a door, the doors of long hidden secrets and self-righteousness that I had begun. And it's a master key, and that master key is available to all of us today. We're very fortunate. It's not given to a select few, but it's available to everyone. And this master key opens the doors of recovery. The recovery doors are steps and traditions and our slogans, sponsorship, meetings, service works, and conventions just like this. You know, Bud and I, from the very beginning, we were told, go to conventions. And we get a lot of recovery out of these meetings and talking with people as you in these groups. I knew right then from the very beginning that Al-Anon was for me. And that it was not the alcoholic that all these years that I thought I hated, but it was what he had done that I hated. And it was the disease that I did not like. I learned to start loving again and started learning to feel compassion and to give the alcoholic in my life the dignity that he deserved as being a child of God. I always thought of myself as a child of God, but I never pictured him as being a child of God. Sponsor that I had early on in Al-Anon was a wonderful person. With her, I could vent some feelings, and I would talk with her, and she never gave me any quick fixes or advice. You know, she would listen, and she would say, you know, I know, and she did know. She really understood, and she loved me and accepted me for who I am. And she introduced me to those tools of recovery, the steps and the traditions. And with her, I could, you know, really vent with this sponsor. And I allowed that steam that was built up inside of me, it was like a pressure cooker. And with her, the steam could slowly escape, and then it could allow the tenderness that was inside of me to come out. And it would allow me to be more happy, joyful, and free that we hear in this fellowship. And, you know, by talking with my sponsor, I didn't carry all my garbage to the meetings. And, you know, she taught me that in meetings is a place to work on recovery and to focus on solutions and not the problems. And that's why I am where I am today in my program. I hear in this room... And, you know, this is one of the great things about being at the podium. Boy, you can just say all sorts of things, how you feel and what you believe and what you've learned. And, you know, I hear a lot that we should never say no in this program. And maybe that's where other people are today, and that's okay. That's okay. That's where they are, and that's where they chose to be. But with me, I learned that it is okay to say no, because I'm one of these people that will just go out so strong, just like when I was in the very depths of this family disease of alcoholism, that I get so actively involved in things and focusing on others and doing other things that I get lost. And then I stop remembering what I'm supposed to be doing for my recovery. And one of the things that I start seeing is that I'm not calling my sponsor as much, that all of a sudden I'm too tired in the morning to read my daily meditation book, my One Day at a Time or The Courage to Change. That form comes in the mail and I tuck it inside the magazine rack. Oh, I don't think I'll go to a meeting tonight. I think I'll stay home and rest. So when I stop volunteering too much, then I can divert that attention back to Ann and start focusing on Ann and what she should be doing. But I am very involved in service work. I'm not saying that to do that. It's very important to me in my recovery. By doing this, I think, you know, by being involved in service, by being involved in, you know, volunteer activities outside of the fellowship, and doing things with my family, when I have time for all of these things and I can space them out equally, then I live a more balanced life, and that's when I can have some serenity. I don't get, you know, caught up in really overdoing things. I always talked with my sponsor frequently, and sometimes I would call her just to ask her a real quick question, and we would wind up being on the phone for an hour or more. You know, she was just really so tolerant of me. I had a very special closeness with the sponsor. I could just really talk to her about anything, and she had been in service work for many, many years, and I learned a lot from her. And last February, she died. She was here one moment, and then with a snap of a finger, she was gone the next, without any warning at all. And, you know, when I got that phone call that night, I'll never forget it, because I remember sitting in the center of our bed and crying and holding myself and rocking back and forth. And I felt that old, familiar darkness of the soul return. I felt really alone and abandoned, and then I felt angry at our higher power. How could he take her away from me like this without any warning? It just did not seem fair. Bud came to me that night, and he held me, and he loved me. He told me to feel my feelings, to feel my sadness and my loss, and to cry. You know, he really understood where I was coming from. You know, that was much different. I had lost my mother when we were in recovery just a few months. And I guess I'm sharing this with you today because we have lost so many people in this fellowship this year. It's been a very difficult year, real, real hard. I've lost count. You know, I used to think 5, 6, 7, and then the numbers grew to where I just don't count anymore. It's been a real hard year. And I think most all of them have been AAs, and I've loved them, and I was close with them. But when I first lost my mother, like I say, when it was early in the fellowship, I would try to cry, and Bud at that time, as he only knew how, would say, "Now, Ann, if you just work these steps, if you work the 12 steps, you're going to be all right. Just work the steps." You know, that's all he said. Then when my sponsor died, he said, "It's okay, cry. Give yourself time. Remember her. Love her." There was a lot of difference in our recovery, and I accepted his help then. When my mother died, I think one of the best people that helped get me through that terrible ordeal was a female alcoholic, Patsy, and I will always be so grateful to her. She's not with us today. And She used to sit and she used to talk to me for a long, long time, and she would call me up. And so I guess that's why I've had so much help from the AAs in this fellowship, along with the Al-Anons, that's why the AAs have a special spot for me in my heart. So I'm here to tell you that those of you that have also lost so many friends this year, to feel your sadness and your loss, and to cry, and to give it time. And time does heal. The next 4 months after my sponsor died were, I think, the very hardest. I really felt like giving up in this program, and I called another friend that she sponsored, and, you know, she went through the same thing that I was going through at the time. But another friend that I sponsor in this program now, she used to call me frequently, and she used to talk with me, and she walked me through this very difficult time with Bud and many of you in this room. She and others gave me hope that I would heal from this terrible tragedy. You know, I learned then that sponsorship works in both ways. I used to feel in the very early days of this program when somebody asked me to sponsor that I had to have the answers, that I was the one that was going to have to guide them and be the all-wise one. And you know, that's not true. That's not true at all. Sponsorship works in both ways. I learn as much or maybe more from those that I sponsor than maybe that I help them. There's many times that there's certain things that they say to me. You know, they'll be talking about themselves and their character defects and things that they happen. And, you know, I sit back and I think, you know, I didn't think about that before, but I do those same things. So I've learned to have an open mind and to listen very, very closely to those that I sponsor. There's been times that people that I've sponsored have confronted me on something maybe that I've said or done. And you know, that's not easy. That's something that will really put me in that mode of humility real, real quick. But I'm grateful to them for that. I'm grateful for them for calling me on situations, because that's another part, important part of my recovery, is to listen and to learn. I now have another sponsor. You know, life goes on. Life is for the living. And she's unable to be here with us today. She did want to be. But she gave me this beautiful butterfly pen as a reminder that she's with me in spirit. But I would have known that anyway. She also helped me through that very, very difficult time when I lost my sponsor. And she helped me realize that, you know, Mel's words and the words of people like Lois and Bill W., you know, all of those that have gone on before us, that their words could continue to live and their ideals through us if we let it. My new sponsor and I were building a relationship of love and trust, and, you know, that takes time. It takes time. And I feel so grateful to have her. I'm very fortunate to have her as a part of my recovery today. You know, I mentioned that service has been a real big part of my recovery. I was only in Al-Anon, I think, just a few weeks when I became a GR of a very newly formed group. Now, this is not the norm, I'm here to tell you. But I think it was my higher power's way of saying, you know, that I needed a commitment to this group. To hang in there and to stick with it. I was one that would start something and then run away from it and give up my hands and quit. But one of the first things that I did as a group representative was to register our group, and I registered it as an AA group. I sent in the wrong form to AA's General Service Office. I was so confused when I got all of this AA literature in the mail. You know, I thought, well, why are they sending that to me? And then the directory, is that what it's called, Harriet? The directory came out, and there it was listed, you know, 12 Acorns. That was the name of our Al-Anon family group. I was so embarrassed. So I got that cleaned up. So, you know, we make mistakes, but, you know, life goes on. Life goes on. It still works. I was told to go, you know, to area assembly and to district meetings and to conventions, that that's where the winners were. And that's where I want to be today. I want to be with the winners, and because that helps me, you know, in my recovery. I want to be with those that are looking this disease straight in the eye and saying that I don't need you in my life anymore, because I don't need this disease anymore. I want to get rid of it. I've got serenity today. Never thought that I would have the serenity that I have. You know, even when I was not a GR, I still attended my district meetings and I attended area assembly. I felt that that was real important. I personally feel that we can't repay back to our fellowships in 2 or 3 years what it has given to us. So I want to keep going back and keeping Al-Anon pure. I'm a strong advocate, those that know me, of conference-approved literature and meetings. I feel like what we read at home is our own business, and that's fine. I read a lot of other things other than Al-Anon. But when I go to my Al-Anon meetings for that 1 hour, I want it to be Al-Anon. And I believe in Al-Anon is for families and friends that have been affected by this disease of alcoholism. There are no quick fixes. You know, we can't be over anxious. You know, I sponsor a girl and she is so anxious to grip this bull by the horn and just ride on straight into total serenity really quick, and it's just not coming that fast for her. And I keep telling her there's no quick fixes, that we just have to take this program slowly, and that it's a slow process, but it is a process that continues to move forward if we concentrate on recovery and if we make our programs part of our everyday life. You know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't talk about Al-Anon or our fellowships with someone, if it be a friend or if it be my spouse. You know, I cherish something that Bud and I do some mornings, and not all mornings, but that we do our meditation together. He reads out of his daily reflections book, and I read out of either my One Day at a Time book or my Courage to Change book, and we hold hands and we pray together. And that's a miracle. You know, years ago, I would have never in my wildest dreams would have thought that this would have been possible. Bud still does not place me first in his life, nor do I him. And you know, that's okay. That was something that was so important to me at one time, and it isn't anymore. Because, you know, I've learned to, my values are a little bit different, my priorities are different. And I know today that in our lives, the priority, that the person or the thing that has to come first in our lives is God and our higher power and these programs, AA and Al-Anon. And if it wasn't for AA and Al-Anon, we wouldn't have the special relationship that we have today with one another. You know, we were both deeply affected with this disease, and it takes time for this progress to move into us and to get better. We, you know, our relationship did not come easy, and I think one of the things that was the most difficult for us was communication. That was the thing that was destroyed the earliest in our relationship. We couldn't talk to each other. You know, things today are not perfect, and without doubt, this communication has been the most difficult one for us to overcome. You know, I thought that once he had stopped drinking that, you know, all of these problems would have just disappeared. I thought that was our only problem. You know, and I found out that that was just a minor drop in the bucket with the problems in our family. And I thought that everything was just going to be wonderful and perfect, but it wasn't. We had to learn how to communicate with one another, to talk with each other, and not to disagree with one another without attacking and pointing the finger of blame. That's what we always did, was always directing the blame at the other person. We used to say, you did this or you did that. And now we try to stay most of the times in the eyes, you know, I feel this, I feel hurt. We try to express our feelings. And we listen to each other today. You know, before, and I'm sure still at times today, I'd listen and he'd have his glassed over look, you know. But today I really feel that he cares about what I'm saying, and it's important to him and in our relationship. Al-Anon has a book, The Dilemma of an Alcoholic Marriage, and I think that that has the greatest thing that I have ever, ever read on communication in it. It's just got those steps and those guides, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that tells you, you know, gives you some wonderful suggestions on how to communicate with one another. And so it's a real great resource in my library. So as I said, it takes time, and it's in God's time, not in our time. In the beginning, Bud and I were told that we needed to, in our recovery, to walk our separate paths. And later, maybe if it was meant to be, by our higher power, that these paths would once again join. And maybe that we could again join hands and walk this road of recovery together in harmony. And this has come true for Bud and I'm so very, very grateful. And the ones that have helped us many years before that we ever got involved in this disease was Bill W. I'm so appreciative to Bill W. for his foresight to realize that the family members also needed help. He saw that we too had problems, and that it was much, the picture was much, much bigger than just the drinking. And I appreciate his encouragement and his support of his wife, Lois W., to help start the Al-Anon program. And I know that without our, you know, the Al-Anon program, that Bud and I would not have grown to such lengths as we have in our relationship and in our programs. I know that without Al-Anon, and if Bud had had AA and I without Al-Anon, that he would have grown much, much further than I would have. And I would have gotten left behind. There's no doubt. Bud is very active, and service AA is so important to him. And I know that today I appreciate the fact that we have this in common, and we have a lot of friends in both fellowships in common. So words cannot express today my appreciation to Alcoholics Anonymous for sharing the 12 steps with Al-Anon and with me. As we all know, you know, these 12 steps give us a wonderful, wonderful way to live. Bud usually closes his talk with saying that he thanks AA for his life and Al-Anon for his wife. We both know that without these fellowships, we would not have the good fortune of being together for as long as we have. On July the 20th of this year, Bud and I celebrated our 30th anniversary, and I am so grateful for that. You know, Buford, I guess Thursday night mentioned, what, 55 years? I thought, all right, we've got a lot to look forward to, you know? We're a long ways from that yet. But, you know, only 7 out of these 30 years have been in recovery, and I'm here to tell you that they've been the best 7 years of my life. I am so grateful. So I want to express my appreciation to all of you for being here today. For all of you that have reached out your hands of recovery and of hope to me, and that you've helped me walk this path of hope. My prayer is today, and it will always be, that I might be able to pass on this program to someone else in need as I was. It was so freely given to me. And if no one else has told you today that they love you, please let me be the first, because I do. I truly love you. And I ask that may the understanding, peace, and love of this program grow in you one day at a time. Thank you for being here.